Hello, and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me today on the line from Salt Lake is Janelle Brown, author of One Sweet Slice, and it's a cookbook about making cupcakes. One Sweet Cupcake is the name of the book, and she owns the business One Sweet Slice. Janelle will be with us for most of the hour as we talk about the different things to help make your production of a cupcake a work of art. So stay tuned with us for the hour, and Janelle, thanks for joining us on the program.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, Janelle, the first thing I always have to ask when I'm looking at a cookbook is, you know, what got your passion going? Why doing a cupcake cookbook?
Well, that's really kind of a long story, but what really drew me into the world of baking, I guess, was actually the art side of things, and it happened with cake decorating. I got interested and I needed a new hobby, and I've always liked to do artistic things, and so I signed up for some cake decorating classes at my local craft store, and that's what got me started into cake decorating. And then after a few years of decorating, I thought, man, if I'm going to spend all this time making these cakes look pretty, they better taste good too, because I had just been using a box mix, and I thought, you know, I really want to play around with the baking side of things more. And so that's when I started to experiment with baking a little bit. So it was more of a gradual process. I wasn't the type of person who, you know, grew up baking with my grandma and just, you know, always wanted to own a bakery. And this was, you know, a passion and a love that I had baking at a very young age. It was something that came with time. It was more of a gradual thing than right away.
You grew up in a rural area. Did that influence this process at all?
It did, and I talk a little bit about that in the beginning of the recipe book, but because I did grow up in a small town, we didn't have, you know, all of the bigger, there was one grocery store, and really a lot of the ingredients and the things that we used came from either our garden or, I mean, I remember my mom making yogurt from scratch, or like, you know, homemade yogurt, and just everything was very organic and very, because not out of the fad of wanting it to be organic, but because that's all we had. Like, we didn't have all the 100 grocery stores to pick from. Everybody just had a garden, and everybody, that's just what you did. And so that really influences as far as the quality of taste or the ingredients that I wanted to use, because that's what I grew up with. That's what I was accustomed to.
Now, you have 4 children now?
I do.
And when you started this process, you just had the one to begin with, but then when you began your store, One Sweet Slice, you had 3 kids underneath the age of 3.
Yes. We actually signed the paperwork to open the store when I was in the hospital with our 4th baby. I just had delivered her, and we had to make a decision of whether or not we were going to do this, and so we signed all the paperwork while I was in the hospital. So her poor life has just been a whirlwind the last 3 years, but it's been good.
So how have you been able to blend this, the business with 4 young children and have it be a success? What are your ingredients for making that a success?
It really comes down to priority and just deciding what you want to spend your time doing. So my husband and I decided that we at all costs wanted to try and make sure that one of us could be home with our kids, because they're so young, and we just wanted to be there for those growing up years and for them to be a part of this. And we thought it would be good for them to see and kind of understand more of what, as a family, we were trying to do. And even though they didn't have much say in whether or not we were going to do it. And for them, it went from something that was just a hobby thing that mom did at home to them really grasping the idea that we were opening a store and a shop and what that meant. And they really have dealt with the brunt of the busy schedules and the late nights and all of that. And they've been so, I mean, as only children can, they've been so understanding and patient and helpful. And they love to come down. And they love to come down to the store. They know everybody who works here. They know, you know, where everything's at. And my son is already trying to negotiate his wage of when he can come and start washing dishes. it's good for them.
This is a call-in program, so if you'd like to join us in our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800 826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and send us your question or comment at that point. As I've looked through the cookbook, I mean, that's the one thing I always look for is, are there going to be pictures? And you certainly have a full color picture for every single cupcake, because as a guy, and I guess I'm extrapolating out to all other guys, but I want to see the photo. I want to have details about every single little thing. So how does this cookbook gel with my ideas?
Well, you're right on. You're right on with that. And that was really an education for me as far as the pictures went. I remember when we had first scheduled the first photo shoot, I was naive enough to think, oh, we'll just have a white background, you know, backdrop, and I'll just make one of each of the cupcakes, and we'll, you know, send it through, take a picture, and the next one, take a picture, and we'll have this wrapped up in 30 minutes. And the photographer, Pepper, that did a lot of the pictures in the book, came in and sat me down and just said, no, you really need to go home and think about what you want this cookbook to look like, what you want the feel to be, because you've got to think about the plate that it sits on and the fork that you use and the linen that's there and the back, you know, ground for it. And so she really educated me as far as a staged photo and how important that was in selling a cookbook, because, you know, when you're at the store, you can't try the recipe, you know, you can't make it there, so you're buying it based on the picture and how appetizing and appealing that looks to you. And so that's really what will sell that cookbook. So it was really important to me to have, you know, some good pictures that really communicated of, you know, the product of what you were going to be able to make.
And each one of these pictures are a cupcake that you make and have in the store?
Yes. Some of them are flavors that we rotate throughout the year, so we don't have them in the store all year round. But our basic flavors are that we have in the store all year round, or in the recipe book, as well as some of the seasonal flavors that we rotate through.
Well, let's kind of dive into things here. So one of the first things, again, I'm always looking at things, what kind of ingredients am I going to need? Because I don't want to open up the cookbook and find some ingredient that I've never heard of and wouldn't know where to find it, and I'm too embarrassed to go over to my neighbor. And you mentioned that you like to bake cookies on a Sunday evening, so where do you find most of your ingredients?
Well, I wanted to write the recipe book so that your average person would, you know, be familiar with the ingredients and have them in their pantry. Because what I found when I was looking at different cupcake recipe books is that you had two extremes. One, they were either all, you know, very organic, very high-end product, you know, very specialty-type shop ingredients that you needed. And then on the other end, it was grab a cake mix and throw in whatever you've got and have a cupcake ready to go. And there was nothing that was kind of in the middle, in that middle ground, which I feel like most bakers are at. They want something more than just a box mix that they add stuff to, but they don't. It's not worth it to them to drive down and, you know, pay $70 for a block of chocolate, you know, that they're only going to use a couple of times. And so this recipe book is developed for you to use the best ingredients available to you, to use the best that you can. So when you go, you know, to your local grocery store, I try to walk through each of the ingredients to explain what you're looking for. And you can find almost all of these ingredients at your local grocery store. The only two ingredients that are a little bit tricky to find, one is the vanilla bean paste, and then the other, it's not hard to find, but you just need to know what you're looking for, and that's the Dutch processed cocoa. So those are really the only two. But even then, you can find it at Harmon's. You can find it, you know, if you just know where to look. There's stores that you go into, you know, once a week. So.
We have an email question from Addison in North Logan. And he wants to know, what alternative types of cupcakes do you offer? Healthy, gluten-free, sugar-free?
Yeah, we do. In fact, this month especially, we just started offering our sugar-free cupcakes. We do gluten-free cupcakes as well in the shop every day, and then we also do vegan cupcakes as well. In fact, our vegan recipe was developed by one of the girls who worked here. It was her grandmother, and it was the recipe that they used during World War II when eggs and milk and butter just weren't available, when they just couldn't get it. And so it's kind of one of the very first vegan recipes without meaning to be vegan for a chocolate cake, and that's what we use for our vegan recipe. But and really, all of these recipes here, if you just substitute the regular flour with a rice flour, you'll still have great tasting gluten-free cupcakes. So it's very versatile that way. And for a sugar-free cupcake, the trickiest part with that is getting a good icing. But we've developed a good one, and we're in the process of putting together a second recipe book and debating whether or not we'll put that recipe in the second book.
Is that available from your website, perchance?
The sugar-free recipe,
yeah.
The icing recipe? Yeah, if you just send me an email, then I can send you the recipe for that sugar-free icing. So that's most sugar-free recipes, you can just substitute your sugar with the sugar substitute. Just a one-for-one baking ratio. Sometimes you've kind of got to play around with it a little bit. Sometimes you want to do a little less of the sugar substitute because sugar will naturally make your cupcakes rise. But a sugar substitute won't do that. And so sometimes if you do a little less of the sugar substitute, it'll help your cupcakes to rise a little. They'll be a little bit lighter.
I tend to, when I see a recipe for cupcakes or cake and it says use a box mix, I run away.
Uh-huh.
Because I'd like to experiment in the kitchen, even though I don't cook a whole ton, but I do like to have fun. What ingredients can you just not skimp on?
I would say vanilla, for one. It seems like such a little part of the recipe, but that's what's really bringing in a lot of the flavor, and that's what ties together a lot of the different flavor combinations. And so you need a good, strong vanilla. So don't do an imitation vanilla. Don't skimp on that. Like, put a little bit of money into your vanilla, and that's where that vanilla bean paste, again, is really an important ingredient when you're doing a lighter or vanilla-based cupcake.
Does it matter where the vanilla comes from, like if you have a Madagascar vanilla versus a Mexican vanilla?
No, it really doesn't. When I was doing some research on vanilla and the orchid that it comes from, it originally only grew on one island, which is what made it so rare, but they've since taken that same plant and transplanted it to other islands. That's what's made it more available now. And it's still rare, which is why, for pure vanilla, you're going to pay a lot more. But it's the same plant still. It's the same bean.
So I shouldn't necessarily be paying more for one grown in an exotic country.
Yeah, exactly. It just sounds so much better, but but it's the same plant. Whether it's grown, the soil, I guess, is a little different. But yeah, you're getting the same thing.
Okay. Well, you've got at the beginning of the book, you split it out into it. There's a chapter called the right ingredients, and you have wet versus dry. And I wanted to go through each one of these and just kind of consider me not quite a novice, but getting pretty close. So I want to know the science behind each one of these and how they work in making the cupcake what it is. So you start out with butter,
yeah.
And I'm fortunate to have access to raw milk. So we like to make our own butter, and you suggest unsalted butter.
Yes. You want to use an unsalted butter primarily because if you have salt added into that, that's going to alter the taste of your recipe because your salt is one of your dry ingredients that you add into it. So if you do use a salted butter, then you'll just have to adjust the amount of salt that you put into your cupcake, or it's going to taste really salty. And that's particularly important when you're making your icing. And because we do add a little bit of salt into the icing as well, and if you start with the salted butter base for your icing, it's just going to be overpowering. We do add a little bit because we don't want it to be like super sugary sweet, but if you start with that salted butter, you can't control the amount of salt that you put into it.
Okay, and so you're using the butter to add flavor and texture to the baking, mm-hmm. What's happening with the butter when it's baking?
So the butter, when you first start your batter, your recipe with any of your lighter cupcakes, you want to make sure you beat the butter and the sugar together because the sugar granules are going to rub up against the butter, and it creates little holes all throughout the butter as it's creaming together. And then once you add your other wet ingredients, and then once you add your dry ingredients and the leavening agent, which is the baking powder into that, as those chemical reactions happen and as the batter starts to heat and bake, all those little tiny, tiny holes that you created with the friction from the sugar and the butter allows the gases from your leavening agent to go into those little holes and to fill that up and create a really light, fluffy cake. So that's why it's so important that you beat that butter and the sugar together, because that butter, that fat's going to blend and melt away, but it's going to leave those pockets, those holes that that gas will fill up, which that's what creates that light, fluffy cake.
You also say it's essential to have your butter at room temperature.
Yes. You just can't whip hard, cold butter. It's great when you're doing a wedding cake and you need a nice, cold, buttercream and a surface to decorate on. But when you go to bake, the temperature of the ingredients that you use, it does matter. So you want it to get that to room temperature. If you don't, you'll have clumps of butter all throughout your batter, which, again, is going to create inconsistency in your cupcakes when you go to bake them.
Can you overbeat the butter and sugar?
No, I mean, you'd have to beat it for a long, long time. So, no, I wouldn't worry too much about overbeating it.
I wonder, and I'm going to try to transfer this over to cookies as well, because when I sometimes make cookies, they go runny, and I think, well, maybe I've got too much butter in there, or maybe somehow mm-hmm. I've overbeat the butter and sugar.
Yeah, and I mean, it really, the overbeating stage happens once you add the flour, because when the gluten in the flour, as you beat that, you're bringing that gluten out. If you've ever made bread, it's that same idea of, with bread, you want to beat it more because you want that gluten to start to react to the yeast, and you want that to happen. But with your cakes, if you overbeat it, it's going to be chewy. It's going to turn them kind of chewy and dense. And so that's the stage you really have to watch your overbeating, is once you've added the dry ingredients.
Okay, so let's move on to milk. You have the extra fat in whole milk adds another layer of flavor to the cupcakes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that problem because of the raw milk that I've got, but I have noticed that when I'm doing breads or doing rolls, that whole milk does make a difference.
Yeah, it really does. And again, that's, I grew up on raw whole milk. Like, that's just what we used, and we always skimmed the cream off the top and would use that, and put it on our peaches, or made homemade whipped cream out of it. And so that's what I was accustomed to. And it does. We use a good quality whole milk here because it really makes a difference in the flavor. It just adds that layer of richness to it when you're baking. It's hard to put into words. You just have to taste it to be able to taste the difference between the two.
When do you use buttermilk in your recipes?
We use the buttermilk in all the vanilla-based cupcakes. And because, again, the buttermilk, it's after you're churning the butter, the leftover liquid, that's buttermilk. And so it's got more of an acidic taste and property to it than just a regular milk does. And again, that just helps your cake to be really light, and it just changes the texture of it. And so that's how we use the buttermilk and the vanilla-based cupcakes.
Okay. And so moving on to eggs, which is, of course, a leavening agent.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make any difference what kind of eggs you use?
Ultimately, again, this goes, if you've got fresh whole eggs available, or, organic eggs that are right there, use them. Like, go, because if you've ever just had a scrambled egg from, one, just a plain white egg you buy from the store versus, good fresh egg, you can taste the difference there. But overall, don't let this be a factor of, now I can't make these cupcakes because I don't have an organic egg. Like, that's not a huge flavor issue with your eggs, whether you just use, ones you grab from the grocery store or if you're doing, like, a firm fresh.
But you do say use large eggs.
Yes, if you want to use a large egg, the recipe is measured out for the amount of volume that's in a whole large egg.
You know, it's interesting. I've got chickens, And so I've been used to using our eggs, but then the winter hits and they slow down because of the day length. And I don't have as many, and I actually had to go purchase eggs a couple of weeks ago. And what they call large in the store seemed quite small to the ones that I'm used to using.
Yeah.
Is it okay to use an egg that's a little bit larger?
Yeah, that's fine. Yep, that's just fine if you want to use an egg that's a little bit larger. And it's not going to alter your recipe a whole lot by doing that.
Okay. And so what are the eggs doing to the cupcake?
So the eggs act as an emulsifier. So they're one of the things that help to blend all of your ingredients together. And then it's kind of what holds the whole cupcake together. If you didn't have any eggs in it, it would be really crumbly. Like it wouldn't hold its shape as well. So that's one of the things that the eggs do. And then the egg yolks there, again, it brings in some of that rich protein and the flavor that comes from your eggs. But that's primarily what they do, is they're helping to hold it all together, is what the eggs do.
And they don't need to be at room temperature.
No, in a lot of baking, it is ideal to have your eggs at that room temperature. But again, I've found it doesn't make a huge difference. If you want to bring them to room temperature while you're bringing your butter to room temperature, go for it. But if it's like, I've got to get these cupcakes done and made in an hour, you know, then you can pull them out from your fridge, make your batter, and your cupcakes are still going to turn out. They're going to work just fine.
Okay, and you use sour cream as well in a few of the recipes. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, the sour cream is in a lot of the recipes. The thing I like about the sour cream, I think it makes the cupcakes, one, so they're not overly sweet. You're bringing in flavor without needing sugar, and that's one of the things that I really like about sour cream. I mean, people's primary complaint about cupcakes is that they're too sweet. And so you want to start with a base that's not overly powering, over sweet, so that then you can really play with your fillings and your icings and everything else without having to skimp on all of that. So the sour cream brings flavor without needing more sugar, and that it also acts as an emulsifying agent as well. And so it brings more moisture to your cake, it brings that flavor, and that it really just helps hold and lock all those flavors together.
Do you know, one of the things I've noticed with cupcakes that I really like is they do have just that right amount of moisture, and they're not too sweet. And I'm thinking of someone here in Cache Valley who makes cupcakes, and she's got this butterscotch with fleur de sel with a little bit of salt on the top, and I love that combination of flavor because it's not, you don't have this overpowering sweetness to it.
Yep, and it's really just that balance of the sweet and salty, because, you know, then if it's too sweet, you get, you know, a couple of bites into it, and then you just can't even finish it. Like, it's just too sweet. So we wanted to make sure that it's a cupcake that you don't want to stop eating. You want to keep going while you're eating it, and that sour cream helps to do that.
Okay. Now, you suggest using canola oil. Explain why canola oil is your ideal choice.
It's just a good baking oil. Just like you have, you know, like olive oil you'd use in breads, or, you know, when you're cooking, just the flavor that comes from the olive oil, like that's what makes it ideal for cooking more. The canola oil is ideal for baking because it doesn't have a really strong flavor, but it still does its job without having to compensate for the flavor part of things. So I don't know. It's just kind of like a good standard baking oil. It's the canola. So.
And looking at all these ingredients, they're not what I would call low fat. Can you have a good tasting cupcake and have it be low fat as well?
You know, I play around with that a little bit, and you can try, but honestly, my opinion is, if you're going to have a cupcake, have a good one, and just have. Let that make your calories count, or I guess make it worth it, instead of trying to devalue your product using, you know, skim milk and more applesauce. And I mean, you can do it, but ultimately your taste and flavor is not going to be as great. If you're going to eat those calories, make it worth it. And so I'd rather rather have you make a smaller cupcake and have it taste good and really enjoy it versus, you know, a big or two or three cupcakes that you're skimping on your flavor and your quality of what you're making.
Well, it's like chocolate. If you get really, really good chocolate, you don't need a whole lot.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I get satisfied very quickly with the really fine chocolate, and I would imagine, like you said, it would be the same with getting a really good cupcake.
Yep, exactly. It's that same concept.
And last, on the wet side of the ingredients, you talk about fruit and the importance of using fresh fruit.
Yes, and that is another thing that's really is important. And that's why we rotate our cupcakes throughout the year based on the season. So, for example, when we do the peaches and cream cupcake or we do the strawberry cupcake, we bring those in during the months where that fruit is in season so that they taste good and that they taste, because there's nothing worse than, like, biting into a fruit, you know, like an apple that's, like, mushy or an orange that's too sour and hasn't, you know, that's just out of season. And so that's why we bring those cupcakes in the season that they're at, because that's the star of the cupcake, is when you're using the fresh fruit, that's what's really going to shine through and the flavor of the cupcake. So you want to make sure that it's fresh and it's good and that you bite into that and think, oh, I love peaches or I love blackberries, because you're tasting the full flavor of that fruit.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm speaking with Janelle Brown. She's author of One Sweet Cupcake from Cedar Fort Publishing, and she's the owner of two stores of One Sweet Slice in the Salt Lake County area. And if you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also leave us a Facebook comment on the Utah Public Radio Facebook page or send an email to zestygarden@gmail.com. We're going to take a real quick break, and then we'll be back for about another 10 minutes with Janelle Brown, and we're talking about cupcakes, so stay tuned.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information at apogeeinstruments.com.
I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
And this is Elaine Taylor.
We are SQ Radio, short for Science Questions, the first local science radio show ever in Utah.
You might remember
Welcome
Sherry.
To Knowledge
she was
in
a host
nutshell.
Of Knowledge in a Nutshell
Quinn.
Way
the
back
universe
in 1999.
Is so massive and so old, it's difficult
well,
to
we're back, and SQ Radio
size.
Brings you behind-the-scenes stories on frontline science and technology, interviewing game changers like Jared Diamond.
If we ignore the serious environmental problems around us and do nothing about them, then world civilization as we know it is not going to
And featuring underdogs like Yaqui Tribe, NASA engineer Ed Galindo, and his fish gardens in space.
Out of 50 fish knots that went up, only 2 didn't survive.
We cover addiction, mental health, wildlife biology, and the list goes on. Join us every Friday morning at 9:30 here on Utah Public Radio, where science is our entertainment.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I'm talking with Janelle Brown, author of One Sweet Cupcake and the owner of One Sweet Slice. And Janelle, I know it's hard. This is a radio show. We can't show everything. We could. I'll put some pictures on our Facebook page and on our website as well. But when you're teaching, do you teach any classes anymore? You used to.
Mm-hmm. I did. I used to teach classes for Wilton, the Wilton Cake Decorating class, and I would teach at various craft stores. Since we've opened here, we do offer little cake decorating and cupcake decorating parties or classes. They're just a one-night thing that we do, and people can come and learn the basics of decorating cupcakes and cakes. But a lot of my teaching now really comes when working with my staff and teaching, you know, my decorators, training my bakers, and that's where a lot of my focus and time comes now instead of bigger classes.
Well, and you had a wonderful opportunity just a little while ago. You won a national competition, the Cupcake Wars on the Food Network. So
yeah.
why don't you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, it was really just one of those chance-of-a-lifetime things to get to do. We had just opened our store. We've been open for a few months, and our customers just kept coming and saying, you need to get on that Cupcake Wars show. You guys really need to get on there and compete. And so my husband came across one of the producer's emails one night and just sent him a quick little email and a picture of our family and just kind of told him a little bit about what we do. And I got a phone call a couple of days later asking us to put an audition video together. So we hurried and put an audition video together and sent that in. And then a few weeks later, we got another call back saying, we want you to come and compete on this show. So they flew us out to L.A., and we spent a week there and competing on the show, and we ended up winning. And our theme was Star Wars, which we were even more excited about, because if you don't like cupcakes, at least like Star Wars. And so that was really fun for us to do. But this was back in February that we had won, but we couldn't say anything until our episode aired, which was not scheduled to air until September. So we had to keep quiet for 6 months and couldn't tell anybody that we had been on or competed or won. So that was really hard, because I felt like we were just lying to people over and over again when they kept asking if we've been on the show yet. But that really did change our lives once that episode aired. And at the time, our shop was doing primarily wedding cakes and custom birthday cakes. And we were doing, I would say 70% of what we did were cakes and 30% were cupcakes. And then after that, our episode aired, it just overnight just switched. And we probably do almost 70% cupcakes now, and 30% of our revenues come from our wedding cakes and our custom cakes. But it just, to give us the credibility, to give us the advertising, to let people know, you know, that we're here, and for them to really come in and try what we do, that we really do have the best tasting cupcakes in the state. Like it made such a big difference, and it was so fun to do. I loved being able to compete. They treated us really well. It was just a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing it.
So what made your entry, in your opinion, the winning entry? Why was it better than all the others?
I would say a lot of the show deals with not only the taste of your cupcakes, but a lot of it comes down to presentation and your time management. And that, I remember watching the show before we were on it, and, you know, watching some of these people competing and think, how could you forget to put baking powder in your cupcake? Like, you do this every day. Like, how could you make that mistake on national TV? Or how could you not finish your cupcakes in time? Like, how could that happen? But then when you're there on the show, you're in a kitchen that's not your own. You have, you know, five cameras around you. You have a producer who's, you know, yelling and asking questions all the time, because, you know, it'd be pretty boring TV if everybody just focused and actually got their cupcakes done and it was just judged, you know, solely on taste. Because without a doubt, all of those people there make great tasting cupcakes, like, when they do a good job with what they do. But it really comes down to being able to handle the amount of pressure that's there and time management. And I feel like for us, coming from a background of working on wedding cakes, which is extremely high pressure, and a lot of times you do have, you know, short deadlines and a lot to accomplish and do, and where your time management is paramount in getting that done and out. And that really, I feel, was a great advantage to us going into the competition, because Kristen, my teammate, and I worked together really well. We worked under pressure and stress, you know, on a daily basis, and so it wasn't a new thing to us. So being able to manage our time and get what we needed to accomplish wasn't a problem, which some of the other contestants struggled with.
Well, you had to bake and frost 1,000 cupcakes on, and plus build what you did, a TIE fighter that you put the cupcakes on.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's, to me, to do that in 2 hours, I mean, I couldn't even build the set in 2 months probably.
Well, and we had, we just had to design the display, so we had other people working on it and building it. So luckily that part was off our plate. We didn't have to focus on that. And then in the final round, they do bring in, each team gets four assistants, and the four people who come in, they're actually culinary students. They're in LA. So, and this is what they do for their part-time job. So they work, you know, with Cupcake Wars every day. And so they're fast. They know how to ice. They know how to get, you know, those cupcakes on the stand. They know how to make curds and ganaches and creams and fillings because they're all culinary trained. So that's a huge advantage as well. It's not like, you know, you just have your sister and your aunt or, you know, people who don't really know what they're doing. You've got four trained assistants who this is what they do. They know how to do this. And so being able to delegate to them was a huge advantage as well, to say, you know, you get this made and you get this made. And then knowing that they understand the time frame that you're working in. So that made a huge difference. And that's what makes it possible is being able to delegate out that responsibility and then, you know, trusting that they'll follow through with it and get it done.
Well, we only have about 5 minutes left. So if you'd like to join our conversation, their toll-free number is 800-826-1495. Send us an email at zestygarden@gmail.com or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page to post your comment there. And so I wanted to look then in your cookbook at the dry ingredients and some of the important aspects there. Salt is kind of the first one that I'm looking at. Can you use any kind of salt? Like for instance, we use what I would say is a sea salt, but it's from Utah. Mm-hmm. It's from an underground cavern. I mean,
and that you can use like a larger grain salt in your baking. The only downside to that sometimes is dispersing the flavor evenly throughout all of your cupcakes. So that's the only trick when you're using a larger grain salt. So just to be mindful of that. But yes, if you want to use, you know, just your regular table salt, like that works. That works just great.
Okay. And the flour, you said you could substitute the rice flour for white flour so it becomes gluten-free. And don't overbeat the batter.
Yes. Yep. That's your biggest thing is you're just mixing until all of the dry ingredients are incorporated into the wet. So you don't want to overbeat or you'll start to activate that gluten more, which will make your cupcakes really kind of heavy and chewy. You don't want to do that.
And we talked about vanilla, so I want to look at the chocolate because you do use that in a lot of your cupcakes.
Mm-hmm.
What are the different chocolates that you use?
Oh, we use anything from like a classic white chocolate to the Dutch processed cocoa. And then, but when we do our chocolate cupcakes, we use a rich, dark chocolate because this allows you to get all of that chocolate flavor without having... Because it's not going into it in a powdered form, you're not drying out your cupcakes. It's going into the cupcake in a liquid form because you're adding that hot water to it, which is melting that chocolate, which allows it to blend with all of the other ingredients. And then once the cupcake's baked, so when you make that, your chocolate batter is going to be really runny because it's got that extra water. But once it bakes, all that water evaporates, but leaves that rich chocolate flavor behind without you having to add so much of the dry from the cocoa powder to try and get more intense chocolate flavor. So that's a great way to get that rich chocolatey flavor into your cupcake. And again, it really comes down to you if you want to go more gourmet, you know, you can go to a, you know, Whole Foods or a gourmet grocery shop and buy a really high-end, you know, good quality dark chocolate, you know, or if all you've got is chocolate chips, buy the best chocolate chips that they sell at the grocery store and use that. So and again, you'll always, if you use the best quality ingredients, you're going to have a better tasting cupcake, but your cupcakes are still going to taste great. They're still going to be amazing if you're using the best of what you have. So
well, now looking at the essential tools to have as well, you suggest having an oven thermometer.
Yes. Yeah, that's a huge thing. Most people don't realize how off their oven temperature is set. They just turn it, you know, on top and think that it's baking at 350 and they're good to go. And the reality is it's not there. So if you use that oven thermometer, that will let you know what you need to adjust your setting on your oven to so that it's baking evenly and that it's baking at the right temperature for cupcakes.
You like using an ice cream scoop so that you can get the same amount in each cupcake?
Yeah, this will make your cupcakes look uniform all the way across, and so you don't have batter that spills out over the edges, or it just makes it a lot cleaner and easier to use.
Do you need to use paper liners, or can you just spray the cup itself?
Yeah, you can spray the cup itself if you want to do that. You can do that.
And
paper
then
liners are less mess, so.
Yes, and then using the toothpick method, does this always work?
Yeah, the only times you really need to watch that is if you're adding other ingredients, if you want to experiment around and add, say you want to add chocolate chips or something to your batter that will melt while they're cooking, then you just have to make sure that when you put your toothpick in, you didn't just stab it into a chocolate chip, you know what I mean, and you think it's raw, but it's not. My favorite way to test is I just touch it with my finger, and if it springs back and if it's, nice and light, then they're done. And on the vanilla cupcakes, they're just barely browned. You don't want them to over-brown at all because you're baking such a small amount of batter in such a small cup that they can over-bake fairly quickly. And once they over-bake, then once they cool and set, they're going to taste really dry after a few hours. So you want to make sure that they're not over-baked.
Now, diving into the book itself, as far as the recipes, you've got this outlined into the classical, which includes the vanilla bean, unbeatable chocolate. You've got a fruity section. You have the dark side, which is where my wife would go, using dark chocolate. I mean, she'd rather have 90% cacao content if she possibly could. There's a lot. You've got icing basics in the back. What I love about this is that you've got pictures showing exactly how to do everything. And the one that popped out of me, since I'm a gardener, are the ones that you call your ballerina cupcakes. But to me, they look like dahlias.
Yeah.
And I love the method where you've got three bowls, small bowls of your icing, just the plain icing, and then you put the coloring into one, and then you take a little bit from that one into the next one and stir it up, and then from that one into the next one. So you get this the colors go from dark until light, and they're all in the same kind of the same palette of colors.
Yeah, they call that ombre. And it's been a really big thing from fashion to hairstyle to cake decorating. So ombre is a really, really big trend right now.
Well, I'll have ombre cupcakes then. In the last 90 seconds, why cupcakes? Why are they so popular? And are they just the fad of the decade and we'll move on to something else? Or are they going to have staying power?
I think cake itself has staying power. I mean, it's been around for hundreds of years. It will continue to be around. That's what you get when you're celebrating those moments in your life that are memorable. You get cake. And it's just the form that cake comes in that will change. And that's right now, cupcakes is the form that people love. And it's great for so many reasons. One, because you can get a variety of flavors without having to bake a variety of different cakes. You can experiment with different flavors and textures and icings and garnishes in just a small bite-sized dessert. And that's what makes them so appealing. They're not messy, they're quick, they're fast, but they're still full of flavor, and you can still be creative in your baking with cupcakes. So that's
I think why they're so popular. And there's nothing like delivering a plate to your church function or to the neighbors or whatever, and they just look totally exotic.
Yeah.
But they're easy to do.
Exactly.
Janelle, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you again for having me on. It's been fun.
You've been listening to Janelle Brown. She's author of One Sweet Cupcake from Cedarport Publications, and she also owns One Sweet Slice, a couple of stores in the Salt Lake area, and she is the winner of the Cupcake Awards on the Food Network, and her cookbook is available now for purchase. And again, we've appreciated having you on the program. Stay tuned for classical music coming up at 11 o'clock, and you've been listening to The Zesty Garden.
I'm Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose. And I'm going to talk to you today about one of the wonderful writers I've discovered and followed for years, and that is John Nichols. He is probably most famous for stories that have been made into movies, like The Sterile Cuckoo from the 80s and the Milagro Beanfield War, which is one of my very favorite movies. He writes about the area in northern New Mexico around Taos, which is where he moved in 1969 when he was in his late 20s and starting a career as a writer in New York City and was kind of depressed about the whole writing scene on the East Coast. So he ended up in Taos in 1969, and he writes with amusement, a wry sort of sense of humor about the joys and tribulations of living in an adobe farmhouse that's always at the mercy of nature. So he is talking a lot about the pleasures of trout fishing and the things that go on when you live in the area around Taos, which is a lovely lyrical area. And one of the favorite things that I have found from a memoir that he wrote is about wood gathering and getting ready for the winter, just the nature of life as winter approaches. This book by John Nichols is called If Mountains Die, a New Mexico Memoir. One of my favorites, as I said, and I think it goes in and out of print. And this particular passage from it has to do with making a wood run. Everybody in Taos has a wood stove or a fireplace, and they gather the most wonderful kind of wood of all, pinon wood, and burn it through the winter. The scent of it still, when I smell that, immediately takes me back home because I grew up in northern New Mexico, too. So here's what John Nichols says about the wood runs. Sometimes, returning from our first wood runs, we forsook the Taos Junction Road and traveled north on 285 to Tres Piedras, then drove southeast on Route 111 in order to pass over the bridge spanning the top of the gorge. No fences ran along the road, and cattle roamed freely. The mesa up there is antelope country, and one day I saw a herd of 25 of them racing across the quiet plain, the first of those animals I had ever seen in the wilderness. Stopping the car, I felt locked in an African vista. Every few miles, a lone juniper cast a dramatic black silhouette. Above the antelope, the full moon was as transparently white as a thin wafer of ice. Later, I stopped at the gorge bridge. The gorge was dark, 700 feet below. The Rio Grande trickle was a shiny lead-silver color, like a delicate vein in a black stone. I got dizzy looking down, and afraid. The fall was so great, and for some reason that silver ribbon trickling through blackness, viewed from warm 7 o'clock sunshine, made me shudder. Later on in the fall of that year, after every wood run, we stopped in the forest beside the old railroad trestle and gathered pinon nuts. It was a good year. In forests all around Taos, people collected the nuts falling from pinon cones. We spread a blanket under a tree, and one of us climbed up and shook the branches. Usually, most of the nuts wound up beside instead of on the blanket, and we crawled on our hands and knees, plucking up the tiny brown nuts one by one, placing them in coffee cans or paper bags. At home, we heated the nuts in the oven or in a frying pan and then nibbled on them constantly for the next 2 years. Suddenly, it was October. Snow had started falling in the mountains. We drove home from wood expeditions, biting open the tiny pinon nut shells and sucking in the raw meat, spitting the shells out the window, our eyes fixed on the white, misty configurations settling over Taos Mountain, winter recurring just above our valley, threatening to bury us all in white at any moment. It was my habit then to stop and pick up birds and small mammals hit by other automobiles. And one day I found a bird I'd never even heard of, a Williamson sapsucker. Another time, out beyond Carson, we found a lovely tan and gray thrasher, a streamlined bird whose colors had come from this earth, but whose delicate shape seemed imported from a foreign planet. As winter approached, we made our last run, and as the final, conveniently sectioned pinon chunks were being unloaded into the 9-foot-high wood pile beside our portal, we both thought our wood could last forever, or at least for the next 2 years. Mercifully unaware that we would be out of logs and half-freezing to death by February, we stumbled inside, stoked up a fire in the combination stove, and then soaked in a hot tub, sore and dusty and smelling of pinyon pitch. Our bodies woozy and in that steamy water voluptuously dreamy. Dressing in starched clean clothes, we cooked up a steak and ate baked potatoes with sour cream, had cabbage on the side, and drank beer. Moths had quit battering around the Portel light bulb. All of the valley trees had turned. Their leaves were starting to fall. In bed, on crinkly, clean white sheets, the windows open, we lay quiet, listening to the valley, smelling apples and pears rotting in our little orchard, and getting faint whiffs also of the snow gathering in the mountains. I have never loved any moment any better. During black early morning hours of October 12th, the first snow fell. Luke came into the bedroom shortly after sunrise and woke me up. Together, we knelt beside the bed, gazing out the window. Ruby and a cat still asleep beside us. Our little lawn was almost white. A fine green gauze atop the snow was made by tips of grass. In the orchard, 1,000 crimson crab apples were perfect cones of snow. Starlings in the high cottonwoods behind the office garage made a racket. The yellow foliage of those trees was bleached by the clinging snow. Chickadees hung upside down from the bent, crisp sunflowers behind the clothesline. A Lewis's woodpecker hammered on a nearby Chinese elm. Luke and I got dressed and started a fire in the kitchen stove and went outside. Clouds lay in smoky streaks across the green and white mountains. Rich blue pinyon and cedar smoke rose from the chimneys all over town. We admired the weather for a moment, and then drove into Taos, and in the popcorn-scented Rexall drugstore bought the Sunday papers, the Albuquerque Journal, the Santa Fe New Mexican, the Rocky Mountain News. Back home, we languished over sausages and hot muffins, reading the newspaper. Snow fell lightly again, although only mid-afternoon. An overcast sky made it dark and crepuscular. Just beyond the small ranchito's church, 6 black-faced sheep grazed on Bernardo Trujillo's front lawn, their bells clinking quietly. A few yards farther along, a group of Indian ponies in a wide Pueblo pasture rested quietly as snow built up on their backsides. Killdeers, invisible in that gloom, screeched all around them. Memories of that type of moment are powerful enough to break my heart a little. The family is no longer together, and Bernardo Trujillo, a friend who helped teach me about the acequia politics and held our ditch together against the onslaught of apathy and progress, died last autumn. I woke up on the morning of his death to the old church bell tolling, sounding clearly throughout our quiet community, ringing out a knell for all things simple and pastoral. After that walk through the first snowy day of our life in the north, we washed all the pears we had gathered earlier and carefully packed them for the winter in boxes of straw. I'm Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose, and I'll see you next time.
You are listening to Utah Public Radio, a service of Utah State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KCEU Price, KUSU FM HD1 Logan. Don't forget you can find this broadcast or any of our other broadcasts online at upr.org.